From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear the story of one Hmong family that immigrated to the United States and learn the history of Hmong resettlement.
The same sort of mechanisms that resettled those Eastern European refugees also resettled Southeast Asian and Hmong refugees into Wisconsin.
Then we'll examine the tensions between local arts groups over UPAF funding.
One of the reasons why this issue is so tense is because there's not a whole lot of funding coming elsewhere. For some groups, ticket sales used to be 60% of their total revenue, and now that number is much closer to 30%.
Plus, our astronomy contributor shares what science fiction films stand out and why. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Nearly every day, there's news about immigration in the United States. This week, we're taking a step back to explore Milwaukee and Wisconsin's immigration history in our series, Making Wisconsin. Today, we'll talk about the history of refugees in Wisconsin, specifically Hmong refugees. Hmong people helped the United States in the fight against communism during the Vietnam War. After the war ended, many fled Laos due to political persecution and settled in the United States as refugees. Wisconsin is home to the third largest Hmong community in the country. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez shares the story of one Hmong family from Green Bay and their journey. He's joined by Con Sua Xiong, a filmmaker who documented her father's migration story in her film, Why My Dad Loves.
I think a nice place to start would be, how would you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Con Sua Xiong. You can also call me NK. My name translates to beautiful otter or beautiful seaweed. A lot of controversy over that, but I am a Hmong filmmaker from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay, I ask because I first learned about you through one of your films, Why My Dad Loves.
Growing up, my dad was always recording us. So growing up, I never really learned about the Hmong history, especially in school. Like, I remember vividly in, like, high school when we were covering the Vietnam War, I was like, they're definitely going to speak on Hmong people. They've got to. And I think there was only one mention, unfortunately. Everything else was about the U.S. And I guess I made this film because I really wanted to connect with my parents. Even now, I still have so many questions, like how much they sacrificed for me and my siblings and how they connect with Laos even now as refugees.
Those are big questions. Mm-hmm. Where are your parents today?
They're in Green Bay. This is where they've been for over 30 years, 9 children and so many homes. So many homes, yeah.
You know, we could go ask them some of these questions.
My dad's just saying that he wants you to know that they don't speak English very well, and so they'll need me to translate.
Something I found interesting about visiting your parents is that they are also storytellers.
Yeah. My dad and my mom loved taking photos of us, taking photos of themselves, especially my dad.
Oh, rewind.
Because we can't rewind in our lives, you know, they wanted to take photos so that they can look back on these specific moments.
Speaking of moments, it sounds like you might not be here if it wasn't for photos.
You are correct. So how my parents met was that my dad was living in Georgia with a few people, including my mom's nephew. And then my mom's nephew came to visit family in Wisconsin. He stole a photo of my mom and brought it back to my dad. And my dad was head over heels, I would say. And so they talked over the phone for a while. This is how I've always seen Hmong people flirt, kind of like, do you like me? I like you. Do you like me? I like you. Do your parents like me? And my dad said that he sent photos to my mom.
Yeah,
Did you hear the emphasis on that?
Yeah, yeah.
He said he only chose the most handsome photos to send to my mom.
So 6 months pass, and?
Yeah, so he hit up my mom and was like, I'm going to come see you, and I'm going to come marry you. And he ended up in Stevens Point, knocked on her door, and...
Yeah.
They're saying that like when they got married, they were just, that was just their life. That's what they set out to do. Get married, have kids. There's no turning back. They didn't even think that they could get this far.
Yeah, I get that. Especially after seeing some of the other photos they shared with us.
My dad was born in 1970 during the Vietnam War. And when he was 13 years old, he decided that he wanted to pursue a better life because he was growing up with the aftermath of the war, which caused a lot of Hmong people to flee Laos. And so he crossed the Mekong River by himself. The river was overflowing with water because it had rained. How long did it rain for, Dad? Seven days, seven nights, rain. When my dad finally made it to Thailand, he spent a month in jail before finally making it to a refugee camp. And there were photos of him there. And a few years after, my mom and her family also crossed the Mekong River and were in a refugee camp as well. This is Mom, So this photo right here is when my mom was at Panatnikum, the camp.
I learned that this is the camp that you were kind of like Americanized, so to speak. Like they would teach you the English language, what to expect in the U.S., how to run a house. And looking at this photo, everyone was so young.
It was very fun for her. living in the camps. The way I imagine it is just like, you know, there's a community there. A community of people who are like all here for a reason and like a bunch of other kids too, y'all. A lot of emphasis on the word koshia, which means like a way to describe like longing, sadness. The way she described it is like you go from the first refugee camp, you like connect with the people there, you make friends, and then you only stay there for a short amount of time, and then you move to the next refugee camp. So you miss the people that you've connected with, you've become friends with. She ended up here in the U.S. And she's like, you don't even know what happened to some of these friends. When they were living in the refugee camps, you know, the idea of like, we have to go through this hardship and then we'll live a better life in the U.S. And he was also thinking that even if I live like okay in the U.S., my kids will go off and do better. And looking at his kids now, he is happy. You know, he's content. He feels fulfilled from watching his kids do their own things and succeeding in their own ways.
Oh my God, to have supportive parents. An incredible perspective. Something I did want to know is how they felt about you. Because you haven't just succeeded, but you've also done it sharing their story and sharing Hmong history, the story of Hmong refugees.
She's happy, but she's also very shy and embarrassed. I think it's because she was saying that it's kind of like you're putting your life out there, and that's scary. And my dad was saying that he's very happy as well, but he also feels like this is just a small fraction of the Hmong story, the Hmong experience. there was a lot more tragedy, a lot more trauma that we couldn't capture, that they couldn't capture, that they couldn't document. And so this is just a small piece of a much bigger picture. This is my grandpa, my mom's dad, who is also a storyteller.
That's it.
So my grandpa's song is about, you know, coming here to the U.S. It's great, it's amazing, but you still long and miss your home country.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your grandpa?
Yeah, well, he's a very talented man. I didn't even know some of the tricks that he pulled out of his pocket when we were recording.
So many tricks.
So he sang for us. He played traditional Hmong instruments. And he grew up in Laos before the war. My grandpa was just talking about how he was growing up. He was someone who listened to his parents, and he didn't play with the kids a lot in his village. And so he's not someone who plays a lot of sports. He was just afraid that he would get hurt if he played.
And here you are in a war for 7 years or whatever.
For the country, it's different.
Some needed background information, which I learned talking with your grandpa, is that the U.S. went into Hmong villages in Laos,
recruited around 30,000 boys and men to fight, including your grandpa.
And as I learned, his brother, which I'm still thinking of that photo of him.
Yeah, that's my grandpa right there. Go ahead, brother. And so his brother actually died during the war. He died in the jungle, Hajongya.
In the field.
And they brought his body back, and my grandpa helped do the funeral service for his brother.
I think something that might get lost is just how brutal this war really was, including when the war was kind of like quote-unquote over and the U.S. withdrew troops.
Yes, that's when it became more dangerous because the soldiers, they no longer had any weapons to protect themselves and their families. And so many Hmong men and their families who fought in the war were targeted and they ran to the jungles. He was scared, but then I think they were just thinking about ways to get to Thailand. My grandpa said he's so happy he's been able to watch what's now, the fourth generation of our family, with the grandkids and the great-grandkids all growing up here in Wisconsin. But I wanted to know, reflecting back, how he feels about the war, because it was scary and it was dangerous. That's when he spoke about his brother. He misses his brother. He doesn't tell anyone, but he misses his brother. He says that it's very important for his family to know his story. He just wants them to know his story.
All right, thank you.
Okay.
Bye. Bye.
You know, something I find incredibly interesting about spending time with your family is just that everyone is a storyteller. And so you becoming a filmmaker felt almost inevitable.
Yeah, so storytelling is so deeply rooted in the Hmong culture. for example, my grandpa is a song poet and he sang for us, which I wasn't expecting him to do. So what took you 2 minutes took me 2 weeks for a project last time. But yeah, and my grandma, she sews flower tapestry, pandao. Pandao is very important to the Hmong culture as well, because for a long time, that was how we kept our written language, which we don't really have anymore. And my dad, when he made it to the U.S., he loved to play with mechanics, and camcorders was one of those mechanics that he played with. And as I say in my film as well, you know, the camcorder was handed over to my mom and she was recording us. Every time I've asked them, like, why did you guys record us when you were growing up? And they really emphasized that we wanted you guys to have something to look back on when you're older. So your history. And so I'm really able to tell these stories because of the sacrifices that they made. Because they chose to come to a country where they felt like their children would be successful and really not have to just survive like they did, but to thrive.
You know, to start this, I asked you how you would introduce yourself. And I'm curious, after telling this story, if I asked you now how you'd introduce yourself, if anything would change.
Yeah, I think maybe a little bit. 안녕하세요. 고은배호원 건초시옹. Hi, my name is Gonsho-seong. You can also call me NK. I am a daughter of Hmong immigrants. I am a Hmong storyteller.
Yae chua tua em blong tau si tuen zwa chua cha chen blong.
That was filmmaker Kon Swa Shong. WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez produced that story.
This year is the 50th anniversary of the first Hmong refugees coming to the U.S. To get a better understanding of how Hmong refugees settled in Wisconsin after fleeing Laos, WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez spoke with Dr. Chung Mua, an assistant professor of Hmong studies at UW Oshkosh.
What can you tell us about the Hmong resettlement process and coming to Wisconsin specifically?
You know, refugee resettlement is sort of like a big kind of messy process. And pre-1980, the U.S. doesn't have a formal federal policy, right, that resettles refugees. But of course, they've been doing it since the 40s and the 50s because of escaping sort of communism and authoritarian regimes in Eastern Europe. And so that's why Wisconsin looks the way it does, because of all of this history, not only because of early immigration of Irish and Germans, but because of the 40s in which we have other Eastern Europeans coming in. And so the same sort of mechanisms that resettled those Eastern European refugees also resettled Southeast Asian and Hmong refugees into Wisconsin. And that is how Hmong folks start to come in. And, you know, 1976, I want to say maybe April, May is when the first Hmong family comes into Wisconsin.
Okay, so that's our state. I'm wondering how Hmong folks ended up in the places they are, because as you said, there was no formal resettlement policy at the time.
I mean, their official policy was sort of like this dispersal policy, right, where they didn't want to burden any single like community with bringing in like a large number of refugees. And so where they initially sort of resettled was in places like Eastern Pennsylvania, Eastern New York, some really rural places, as well as some really urban places, right, like Philly, like Chicago, like Seattle, you know, so you have Seattle, Philly, Chicago. You also have places like Providence, Rhode Island. You have places like Rochester. So that dispersal policy, you know, was sort of like the U.S.'s government of like, hey, let's not send everything to one so it doesn't exacerbate that sort of social resources, right, of that environment. And so you can imagine, right, that that immediately produces other challenges as well. And you know where I'm going, because I'm going to the R word, right? So racism rampant immediately. There's stories in Wisconsin newspapers capturing some of these things, thinking Hmong people eat dogs and cats, people being afraid of like their pets, you know, being around Hmong people, or they are blaming Hmong folks for all the geese and the ducks at the park. What's happening to them? They're just like wild people like that, right? So you get all those challenges of just rampant racism. And then people start to do a secondary migration, which isn't unique to Hmong folks, right? They start to move to where their people are. And that's why you have sort of like these really big enclaves in the Twin Cities, and then in Fresno, in Sacramento, right, in California, in Wisconsin, right, there's a huge concentration in Milwaukee, Eau Claire, La Crosse, Wausau, as well as in other places too. And so people like started to move because it's natural to want to be with your people and to be with your family. They want to reunite with family that they've been separated from. And so they do the secondary migration, and that's where you sort of get some of these settlement patterns that we see now.
What do you think is the legacy of Hmong people through this story? Because when I think of refugees, they are newly stateless people, but Hmong folks are, in a sense, double stateless. Like, even their return home isn't necessarily a home.
I want us to rethink about, like, you know, sometimes statelessness is like, oh, like these poor stateless people, they don't have a home, they don't have a country. But I want to say that statelessness is our superpower. If you look at the history of the world, of nation states, of civilizations, people who don't have a territorial homeland or a geographical homeland were not supposed to have made it through the centuries. But I'm like, hey, we're here. We have crossed numerous mountain ranges. We've crossed a few oceans, who knows how many other bodies of water, and we are still here. And there are many things that the Hmong folks in the United States are doing that is vibrant and dynamic, and that is adding to the communities that we have become a part of. We are good neighbors. We have added more flavor to the food of America, right? And Hmong food is a conglomeration of all the places we've been at. There's Chinese influences, there's Thai influences, there's Lao influences, right? And so we have added to that too. And we've added our story to the story of the United States, that in some ways, what makes the U.S. special is the fact that because of all of its failures abroad, that's why there's so many like people here, right, of all different ethnicities and backgrounds. And I hope that it reminds people constantly of, hey, at some point, the white folks who are here, they also ran for a reason. And anyone who is coming now to the United States, who is risking the life of their families, right, to cross borders, to go through dangerous territory, to risk death, they're doing the same things that the pilgrims did when they crossed the ocean, not knowing what they were going to find on the other side. The U.S. is part of that bigger legacy of sort of trying to find something new, something better, and starting to recreate community in a place where wasn't meant for you, but really sort of staking your claim that I can contribute to the community that I have become a part of, and I can make it better. And I can sort of be part of how we can create a future in which we all can exist together. It's not a legacy that's unique to Hmong folks, but Hmong folks certainly have their story to tell about how they've contributed.
That was Dr. Chung Mua, Assistant Professor of Hmong Studies at UW Oshkosh. She spoke with WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez. That was part of WUWM's series, Making Wisconsin, Our Immigration History. You can learn more at WUWM.com. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. How does a person who studies space feel about sci-fi movies set among the stars? We'll find out in about 20 minutes. But first, we'll learn about tensions between local arts groups over the distribution of UPEF funding and how things have changed since the pandemic. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The United Performing Arts Fund, also known as UPAF, supports over a dozen local arts organizations to the tune of nearly $10 million a year. But in an era where Wisconsin has consistently ranked at the bottom of per capita art spending nationwide and declining ticket sales since the COVID-19 pandemic, infighting over this funding has become more intense. Evan Musel is the arts and culture editor for Milwaukee Magazine. His article on the battle over UPAF's funding is featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. He joins Lake Effect Sam Woods for a conversation about the state of arts funding in Milwaukee. He begins with a short history of UPAF.
UPAF stands for the United Performing Arts Fund, and it is the primary fundraising vehicle for 14 of Milwaukee's performing arts groups. What that means is it's essentially a giant fundraiser for all of these groups, and the money is spread out between them. And the way that it fits in the arts ecosystem, the arts funding ecosystem, is that for many of these groups, ticket sales are a part of their revenue, but it, especially in recent years, makes up an increasingly smaller part of that. And so to sustain these groups, they rely on mostly on donations and philanthropy, and that's where a giant piece of UPAF comes in. So essentially, the idea behind UPAF, it was formed in 1966, and it ran its first campaign in 1967. And it was started as a way to raise money for the groups that were housed in what's now the Marcus Performing Arts Center. The idea being it worked as an efficient way for both the arts groups and for donors. The arts groups no longer needed to have their own fundraising offices, and they could consolidate resources in that sense. And then donors could support Milwaukee Arts as a whole and donate to one place and have that money spread between those groups.
You mentioned that these funds are redistributed. How do we decide who gets the money that goes to UPAF every year?
Between the 14 groups that receive money from UPAF, they're split into two categories. One is six of them belong to the Cornerstone Group. These tend to be the larger groups like the Milwaukee Rep or the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra. And there are the eight member groups, which tend to be smaller groups like the Milwaukee Chamber Theater or Present Music. And so the way that the money had been distributed before was that there was an allocation committee made up of members of UPAF's board, and there would be a fixed percentage of who gets what from whatever money was raised that year from UPAF's campaign, with some wiggle room for other factors to consider. Cornerstone groups receive a higher percentage of funds than member groups altogether, and historically, the split has been 85% of the money has gone to Cornerstone groups and 15% has gone to member groups. And then between that 85%, that is split up between six groups, and the 15% is split up between the eight groups. Now, in the past, this number hasn't been exactly rigid, and that's where things like donor designations, where someone donating to UPAF for a certain amount of money, say $5,000 or $7,500, could designate a percentage of that money to whichever group that they want to support. And there were things like the financial scorecard, which would grade groups' finances and give them either a quality rating, which could give them the chance to receive more money from UPAF, or receive a poor rating, which they would receive feedback on how to improve their financial situation and possibly be placed on probation, in which they would receive less funds.
Gotcha. So to recap, there's two distinctions within UPAF's 14 members. There's cornerstone groups, which are higher budget institutions like the Milwaukee Rep or Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, and member groups like Milwaukee Chamber Theater or DanceWorks MKE. And the cornerstone groups take a larger chunk of the pie, historically around 85%. So what is the rationale behind cornerstone groups getting a larger share of this shared funding?
Yeah, so I think the argument that's being made for cornerstone groups is essentially that they have larger budgets and they believe that they reach larger audiences. And therefore, with the amount of money in the arts funding picture and the threat of that money shrinking at any point, that more of those dollars would reach more people if they were funded to the larger groups. The counter argument to that is that even though these groups are larger, and even if in some cases they have more seats and put more people in those seats, the kind of plays that the Milwaukee Rep puts on are very different from the kind of plays that, say, the Milwaukee Chamber Theater puts on. And one of the arguments is that for a healthy arts ecosystem, you need all groups to attract and retain audiences, and also to attract and retain talent. The argument that I hear is that larger groups are needed as kind of like an anchor for the arts scene, but actors, for example, like having options and other places to explore their creativity and also, you know, just other work so that they can, you know, sustain a life here, set down roots and make Milwaukee home for many of these artists.
Yeah. So I can see kind of two things emerging here. I can see how, you know, this division between cornerstone and member groups could certainly cause tension, especially when there's big money on the line. But also I'm hearing a recognition that, you know, we need a diverse ecosystem. How exactly we distribute the funds, you know, we'll get to the politics of that, right? But I'm hearing there's at least acknowledgement that there is something to be said for a diverse set of options in the arts world here in Milwaukee. So let's get to how funds are raised. So we've talked about, you know, how funds have been distributed, but who are UPAF's funders?
Yeah, so a large chunk of UPAF's funding is done through workplace giving campaigns. And how those work is that a corporation like, for example, Northwestern Mutual have a program where their employees can designate a small percentage of their paycheck to go towards UPAF. And this is up to the discretion of the corporation, but they offer to one-on-one match whatever employee contributions are made. And so this is kind of a way for UPAF to reach kind of like everyday people and build momentum for the campaign. So basically, workplace giving campaigns make up about 30% of at least last year's UPAF funding total. And another 39% came from businesses and matching gifts from those businesses. So the primary source of UPAF funding comes from those two models. There's also a significant chunk of individual gifts, and that can range from anywhere from, you know, $5 to $50,000. And that makes up about 20% of UPAF funding.
You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Sam Woods, speaking with Evan Musel about competition over arts funding through the United Performing Arts Fund. And Evan, in your article for Milwaukee Magazine, you detail how the COVID-19 pandemic changed this arts funding landscape. Can you explain how?
Yeah, so before the pandemic, there's always been some infighting between the cornerstone groups and the member groups. And the pandemic really kind of only exacerbated that. What I had told you earlier about the financial scorecard and the donor designations, that's kind of how, up until last year, how UPAF had distributed funds. What the pandemic did was that for all of performing arts, they had to close their doors. They had canceled performances. Suddenly there's no ticket revenue. There's no, you know, they're not able to do what they are meant to do. And they were able to kind of float by the first year because that also meant production costs were low because no one was producing anything and with pandemic relief money. But then after that, since the performing arts groups have opened their doors, all of them have struggled to sell as many tickets as they once have. And that's something that's the same for all groups across the board. Because of that, there has been an even greater reliance on private philanthropy and raising money through groups like UPAF. And because there's a greater reliance on receiving money from UPAF, then you start to get more of that infighting of, okay, well, money is limited. Because fundraising for UPAF has been down in the past couple of years, and that has also been to a number of factors. But when there's a smaller pie, you start to get a little bit worried about your take of that pie.
So as the UPAF pie is getting smaller and we see a bit more infighting between Cornerstone and member groups over time, how has this affected the share of revenue that goes to Cornerstone versus member groups?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. So there's both a shrinking amount of dollars that UPAF had been receiving and a higher demand for those dollars. So in the past few years, we've seen that traditional 85, 15% get something closer to 75% going to Cornerstones and 25% going to member groups. And big reason for that being that UPAF was pulling money from its reserves to offset some of the losses that the member groups were getting. Because, you know, at the same time, nothing has got cheaper. So costs are increasing too.
What are relationships like these days between these groups, and particularly between these Cornerstone groups and these member groups? You mentioned pies getting smaller. Do these 14 arts groups still see this as, we are in this together, even if we disagree on the margins, this still benefits all of us, we're still in this together? Or do we start seeing that cracking these days?
Resentment is still lingering. Effective of this campaign, the 85% going to Cornerstones and 15% going to member groups is effectively solidified, and there has been a formal elimination of the financial scorecard process and the donor designation process, in the sense that donors can only designate to a very specific program of UPAF and not individual members. And so this has resulted for some member groups receiving up to 50% less than what they had received before. Now, UPAF is mitigating some of these losses through its reserves for this year, but that is being taken on a year-by-year basis. But ultimately, what the case is that all of these groups need money from UPAF, and all of these groups have to work together to raise money for UPAF. So there's still a bit of unity there, but I think the worry is that Cornerstone groups and their donors continue to sway the decisions, made by UPAF in terms of allocation or its interests, that this, working together could potentially fracture.
Now let's come full circle to where we started with how UPAF fits into the larger arts funding ecosystem. So, as you mentioned, seems to be some infighting within UPAF and fighting over this one particular pie, this one particular set of funding. But Wisconsin as a state, from its state government, has consistently ranked last or second to last in arts funding per capita among other U.S. states. Is there any evidence that these groups within UPAF are working together to create other pies as much as they are battling over this one particular pie?
Yeah, so one of the reasons why this issue is so tense is because there's not a whole lot of funding coming elsewhere. For some groups, ticket sales used to be 60% of their total revenue, and granted, this is years ago. But now that number is much closer to 30%, which is not healthy, and that's for all groups. Another piece of that, as you mentioned, is state arts funding, which, to put it delicately, is close to non-existent. Wisconsin tends to fall either 49th or 50th in arts funding per capita in the nation. It flips between each year, which is not great, especially considering that neighbors like Minnesota give nearly $10 per capita. And so I think the consensus among all arts groups is that, yes, we would love more funding from the state, but it's kind of seen as not a solution to the problems, more of a pipe dream. Now, there are efforts being made currently to increase state arts funding that might get removed as we speak, but there is an item in the state budget to raise Wisconsin's amount of money per capita for arts funding, which would make difference for many of not just the performing arts communities in Milwaukee, but for all arts organizations in Wisconsin. But certainly the lack of state funding is one of those pressures being added to the situation.
Well, we will see what the future holds. Evan, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Evan Musel is the arts and culture editor for Milwaukee Magazine. His article about the state of UPAF was part of this month's Milwaukee Magazine. We've got a new season of Bubbler Talk on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll discuss sci-fi films with our astronomy contributor. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Science fiction and film tends to lean more into fiction and may not always be factually rooted in science. But when a film bases its storytelling or concepts on actual scientific theories, both novices and experts can appreciate it. For our astronomy contributor, Jean Creighton, there are a few sci-fi films that stick out. She joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to share why.
So today we're doing something a little different and kind of combining both of our loves of the topic, but also medium. And I'm a big film person. And for you as a scientist, I'm curious about your mindset when either you hear about a new sci-fi film or are about to go see one. Are you excited? Are you already like diving into the topic? What's kind of going through your brain?
So I hope this is not a terrible disappointment to you, but I did not come to science from science fiction. And I recognize that for a lot of people, that's the link. For me, the link was, I just want to understand something about how this all works. That doesn't mean that I haven't appreciated movies. And I certainly have watched my fair share of things like, you know, Star Wars and things in that of that nature. So I am not the person who is going to, without asking questions, look at any old sci-fi movie. That's not me. However, there have been some movies that depict what other worlds might look like that I thought were particularly good. And I guess that's what we're talking about today.
Yes, it is. And I do love and appreciate your perspective of it, though, that your route to science was not through media, right? So when you are watching something, do you find that a good story is more important for you in a film than scientific accuracy? Because if someone's going to watch a film with you or, say, your husband, who's also a physicist, you know, are they nervous about like, oh, what are they going to nitpick on this?
Don't know. So that's a great question. There's a time and a place where I think, okay, that's not right, but I see why they did that. It makes sense in the story. It adds drama. Sometimes you just get mad because you think, okay, that's just silly now, and it does nothing for the story. So what was the point of this? I remember, for example, in Contact, one of the movies that we'll talk about, I remember thinking, yeah, that's not exactly right, right? The scale for time was a little wrong. But then I thought, yeah, but this makes a great visual. It makes a great something you can relate to. So I thought, okay, well, don't be so nitpicky. It's okay. The concept is there. The detail isn't right. And I'm sure it was a choice that was made rather than they didn't know better.
Right. And let's start with Contact. It's one of my personal favorite sci-fi movies. It still holds up, in my opinion. It's still a great story. Kind of balances, you know, the scientific with the personal. It takes a big journey. So for you, what's, if you want to like give a brief overview for people who maybe haven't seen it or perhaps some younger listeners aren't even familiar with it, stars Matthew McConaughey and Jodie Foster. So yeah, why does Contact stick out to you?
It sticks out to me because, well, let's just back up a little bit. What is this? It's talking about an astronomer who her life sort of goal is to try and eavesdrop on aliens. She's hoping to hear what we call technosignatures. So proof that there are other creatures out there that are talking either to each other or we somehow get their signal. And what I love about the movie is how carefully and well they explain how is it that you can even think you could do this, right? How do you look for that signal? How do you look for a signal that a person or a creature who obviously doesn't speak the same language as you do, how do you communicate? How do you figure out that out of this, and this is before AI, before machine learning, how do you even begin to do this? And I thought they did a beautiful job of explaining that. And I know how hard that is. And it's a genuine question rather than in so many sci-fi movies, we just start talking to aliens like boom, like we speak the same language and it's English, of course, or whatever. And you think, well, it's not going to be that way, is it? So I love that piece of realism. I also appreciate the excitement that is shown by a scientist who's a woman. And since I've had experiences like that, I could identify.
Now, to go back to a communication theme, this comes up in the next movie we'll talk about. It's 2001, A Space Odyssey. So, you know, there's HAL, which I like to call our computer room at the station. You know, it's benevolent for now. But why does A Space Odyssey stick out to you?
So that's a special movie because from an aesthetic point of view, it seems to me that 2025 is as close to 2001 in terms of what things look like. And I'm sure that to some extent people got inspiration from that and said, okay, well, let's make our computers look this way, you know? And also simple things like in 1968, he's already got people on Zoom calls, you know, something that's just simply at that point was science fiction. But again, you have a genius who figures out, well, what would be good to do? What could I imagine doing? And they can predict things that are going to be happening in, you know, 50 years or more. So you got to give people points for style. And of course, there's this gorgeous initial shot where, you know, I forget now if they're bonobos or chimpanzees, but they take this bone and they put it up in the air and it translates into a space station. It's like, ah. Now, having said all that, we watched this movie. We tried to indoctrinate our now adult kids. And, you know, these people, our sons now are in their 20s. And you could see they were getting a little restless. This is a little slow. And toward the end, it's true that it gets a little, perhaps, too psychedelic at the end. But as I said, some components of space exploration, how the moon is depicted, even though at that point we hadn't actually landed on the moon yet, is kind of mind-boggling to me that he got it so right so many times.
And lastly, we're going to fast forward a bit. We've stuck with some, you know, past decades here. But Avatar, speaking of a filmmaker who's playing a long game, James Cameron certainly is with a lot of these films. So what about Avatar appeals to you? And I admit, I was pleasantly surprised to see this on your list.
I loved the depiction of life and the concept that a whole planet communicates through living creatures that their networks within trees. I love that idea that there are ways that nature can warn. And we know that to some extent this happens, right? We know that if there is a drought, that plants can kind of say up and warn other plants around or disease is coming. So I love the aesthetic of it. I really do. And the idea that you can send an avatar of yourself to explore, because that avatar is going to be much better suited to the environment. You won't be able to live there just like that. But through that is an exciting idea. And I don't know if we're ever going to be able to do this, but I think it's an interesting idea.
Absolutely. Well, I think we've suggested a few options for people for their next movie night if they haven't seen any of these titles. So, Jean, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your favorites with me today.
Oh, thanks so much for having the conversation.
Jean Creighton is the director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium and our regular astronomy contributor. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. You can find more of their conversation at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, our immigration history series concludes with a conversation about how the idea of citizenship has changed over time in the U.S. Plus, we'll look at a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel report on why teachers have left Milwaukee public schools. Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.